last week, if you were here, you know that we started a new series that we're calling Origin Stories. And if you weren't here last week, you can find it online or find the podcast. What we're trying to do is we're trying to go back to the oldest stories in the Bible, the very oldest ones, and the ones we're going to do this year are like, or this week are like 6,000 years old, these stories, and older. And we're trying to ask the question over and over again, why do these stories exist? And not only why do they exist, but why did the editors of the Bible decide, yeah, we should tell that story. That one should be a story, because we all edit, right? We all have stories that we tell. If I asked you to tell me, like, what are you about, you would be editing your story right now. You would, like, decide who I am, decide how much time we have, decide what kind of mood you're in, and then you would tell me a story about you. And then the next time somebody came along and asked a story, like, tell me about you. You might tell different stories, right? Because you have more time and you're in a better mood and the person that you're talking to you like better than me and you think that they'll listen better, right? Anybody do this? Do we recognize that we all do this? We all tell different versions of our stories all the time. That's just part of what we always do. And so that's what's happening often in the scriptures is we find scriptures telling different stories and choosing and editing and leaving things out and putting things in, and we did some of that last week. So this morning what we're going to work on is this idea that there's two creation stories. About five or six years ago, for the very first time, somebody said to me, you know, there's two creation stories in the Bible, right? And I said, what? Up until that point in my life, I had no idea that there was more. How many of you grew up in a situation where you understood that there was two creation stories in the Bible? One person, two. How many of you, this is new within the last 5 or 6 years? So why are we just finding this out as adults? What's happening? Well, one of the things that's happening, and I wanted to do this, I should have done this last week, but I want to spend just a minute here, is sometimes people say things like, you know, like people have believed a certain way for 2,000 years, and all of a sudden, we just think everything's wrong. We're changing everything, right? Have you ever heard anybody say something like this? One of the things you need to know is that beginning in the mid-1900s, there was a biblical archaeology, like, boom that happened. And so over the last 100 years or so, there has been tons of archaeology done of sites all over the Middle East. And so part of the reason that there's so much new information to be had about the Bible is we've never lived in a time where we know as much about the Bible as we do right now. Because of what we found in archaeology, like this morning, later on, I'm going to talk about the Enuma Elish, this Babylonian document. It was found in 1965 in the excavation of a Babylonian king named Ashurbanipal, or something along those lines. And so part of this, and part of this, what we're going to be doing in the next couple weeks is kind of pulling some of this stuff out and saying, hey, we just know stuff now that a scholar born 100, 200 years ago would have had no access to. They wouldn't have even known anything about the Enuma Elish, and yet this morning it's going to be a big part of why this text matters to us is understanding the creation stories and their relationship to the Enuma Elish. How many of you know the Enuma Elish? Just curious. One, two, know of it. You've heard the words before. All right, that's good. We've got at least a baseline of people who have heard the words Enuma Elish. And the rest of you are going to feel so much smarter this morning. So turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 1 is where we're going to go. If you don't know where that is, here's how you find it. Open the cover. And then you're there. I think you have to go through a couple pages of like table of contents, the page that says the Bible. I think that's also called a title page. I think it's only called a title page. All right. Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. This is how this one goes. This one familiar? This is, what kind of literature would we call this? If you had to, like, if I'm high school English class, what kind of literature are we reading? Poetry. The way it's presented to us in this Bible, it comes to us as poetry. It reads in the Hebrew like poetry. It's poetry, all right? And so this one is the one that we're probably most familiar with, where we hear the, this happened, God said this, this happened, and then the evening and the morning were the first day, and God saw that it was good. And we get down to the end, if you just kind of scan down through that, we get down to chapter 2, verse 2. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing, so on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it, he rested from all the work of creating he had done. And then what does verse 3 say? How does verse 3 start? This is the account of the heavens and the earth. Time out. What have we been doing for the last chapter and 3 verses? It's in verse 4. I'm sorry. What have we been doing for the last chapter? If this is the account, what were we doing back there? So let me tell you how I was raised, how my education went and how I was raised. Is I was always taught that when the Bible seems to have two conflicting accounts about anything, our job is to do what? What's that? Make it fit. Smooth it out. Make it work. Weave them together. All right? So what I was taught is that when I got to Genesis 2, chapter 4, and it says this is the account, I was supposed to somehow make this account and the first account a super account, and that's how it actually works, okay? I've used this example, I used it just a couple months ago when we were going through John, about how the Gospels tell the story of Judas dying. How did Judas die? He hung himself, or he fell over in a field, in the words of the King James Version, his bowels spilled out, all right? So in one version, Judas hangs himself. In the other version, somehow he cuts himself open and his guts go everywhere, all right? So there's two ways of looking at this, right? The one is that Luke heard it one way, and I think maybe it's Matthew, heard it a different way. And both of them are just reporting what they heard, right? None of us have ever had this problem, right? We're like, oh, I heard this story, and you tell the person what you heard, and then your friend is like, well, I heard it the other way. And like, that's one way of looking at the Gospels. The other way of looking at the Gospels is, oh no, here we have a contradiction. We need to smooth it out. So I was literally taught in college, in my conservative Bible college, Baptist college, that this is what happened. Judas hung himself, but the rope that he hung himself was kind of weak. And so the rope broke. And when the rope broke, he fell down. And when he fell down, then he cut himself open on a rock and his bowels spilled out. Which is entirely possible, I suppose. Right? But that's what I was taught to do always. And that was the only possible explanation. And so what we're going to do in this series, and what I want to do this morning, and I'll make a bigger point of this when I come back to it at the end, is say that no, sometimes the Bible just has contradictory accounts. Sometimes it just tells us two things that don't actually agree with each other. They're not the same. And that really, when we notice things aren't the same, that's when we ought to pay special attention, because that's probably what the point is about. So let me say one last thing, and then we'll get rolling on this. So I haven't referenced Hamilton in a couple months, so here it is. Gratuitous mention of Hamilton. Was that a thumbs up? Let's say that you really hate Hamilton. I just offended Dave Lynn, all right? Let's say you've just decided everybody's all crazy about Hamilton, and gag me, I hate it, it's dumb, it's wrong, okay? Then what you might want to do is you might want to create your own Hamilton. And in your own Hamilton, you're going to create this one. Like, you hate this whole narrative that's going on, so you're going to create a new musical, and you're going to call it Burr. And in this version of the story, Burr is the hero, and Hamilton is the one full of angst and dead. Because, I mean, obviously, he died, so he was the loser. And so you decide to write it about this winner, Aaron Burr, who learned to shift with the sands, and I don't know what you would say, but the point is that what would happen is if historians came along later and saw these two musicals, one named Hamilton and one named Burr, and they kind of are about the same things, but they seem to have varying details about things, what would be the most interesting thing about studying those? It'd be the differences. Because in studying the differences, you would say like, oh, they were trying to make a point here. I understand. Oh, I get it now. All right? And so that's what I think is happening here in these first two stories. So let's just mine these stories for just a minute. So here's what we're going to do. Everybody over here, you're story number one. all right? I'm going to ask questions, and I want you to flip in your Bible, or just, you don't even have to flip, just read that first page, and I want you to answer the questions I'm going to put up on the screen, okay? You guys are story number two, all right? So you're going to start in 2:4 and study down through 2:25, and you're going to answer. This is going to be backwards because I just did the number one on my right and the number two on my left, which is backwards of what it should be, but we'll deal with it, all right? So let's start rolling through this, okay? So the first question we have about this narrative, what is the literary style? We already did this one. What's the literary style here? Poetry. What's your literary style? Prose. It's narrative, right? It's not the same thing as that at all. It's so when we read poetry and we read prose, we read them differently, right? What do we assume when we read poetry? Not literal. You're on the wrong side to answer this, though. All right? What do we assume? What do we assume when we read poetry? Not literal. Metaphorical. That's right. So if you went to Hamilton, let's call Hamilton at least some form of poetry. It's lyrical and all that stuff. I'm just going to spoil this for you. Well, Hamilton is not historically accurate in a lot of ways. It's not. It's beautiful, right? So sometimes for the sake of, Jennifer and I just watched last weekend the movie 13 Hours about Benghazi. Anybody believe that's exactly the way it happened? No. Every time a movie is made, we call it artistic license, right? Poetry is full of artistic license. So is prose sometimes, but we're going to pretend not for just now. All right? How do we read prose? How is it different? It's usually more factual sometimes, unless we're reading, you know, like fiction and we know it. Not so much the Harry Potter, but if only. Yeah, so poetry usually, we're often being concise. And like here in prose, like my favorite kind of prose is usually literary fiction that spans like 50 years, right? Like big, sweeping 800-page books, right? Yes. Anything else? Tells a story. Yeah. Yeah, and poetry can tell a story, but prose usually is the way we're going to tell a story. I mean, it would be pretty amazing if I told you the story of yesterday in poetry this morning, but That would take too much time and work, and I'm not going to do it, all right? All right, so let's just keep moving. So obviously, these two stories have different styles. How long did creation take? Group one. 7 days, and at least 6 days, you're right, and then Sunday to watch NFL. Either on your side, either six literal 24-hour days or at least epochs of time. The idea is if we're going to study this passage, there's like this clear day one, this happened, day two, this happened, day three, this happened. How long did creation take in your poem or your narrative? We don't know. Good. Good answer. Right? We have no idea. It's just not, it doesn't seem important. So here's a big difference, right? The most important thing about story one seems to be the time frame, right? Evening, morning, day. Evening, morning, day. Like, that's the most important thing about that poem is the time frame in which it's happening. And this story over here doesn't care about time at all. All right? What preexisted the creation? Story one. Nothing. Void. The Spirit of God is hovering over the tahum, the deep chaos. What exists before the creation? At least land and water. Yeah. This is not a detail that can be both and, right? Now, but like the time thing, we could just say that, oh, your story didn't mention it, but it also assumes the 24-hour thing. But your story is chaos out here and nothing. Your story, there's land and water at least, right? Let's go to this one. What's the order of creation? You guys, I'm going to save you some chaos, all right, here. God creates space, days 1 through 3, creates light, divides, pushes the waters around, creates land, and then God fills the space with fish, with birds, with animals, and then finally the coup de grace with human beings. What is the order of creation in your story? I'll help you get the first one started. First, there's what? There's a man. Then there's what? Then there's a garden. Then there are, and then finally, A woman. You can read. Very good. Nobody else around you apparently can. So do you see, again, details that don't fit? This isn't the same story. The one, and even in the first one, when human beings are created, it seems like they're all created. Like the word Adama means like humankind is created. And this one, it's a specific man in a garden. The animals are paraded in front of him. And then like, oh, well, somebody said to me this week, women are created as an afterthought. I'm quoting somebody else. I don't actually think that. But that's how the story almost lays out. Like, oh, I guess the animals won't do, so we're going to have to create a woman for him. That's the way the story reads. Not what I think, all right? What is the manner of creation? How does creation happen in your story? God speaks it. He just says it happens. What happens in your story? What's the mechanism for creation? How does God, is he speaking or what's he doing? Forms, planting, there's plants, builds, breathes. What do we see then about God in this? What is God like? If that's true, what is God like in these? What's the God of Genesis 1 like? Tell me what he's like. He likes to talk? Sure. He's powerful. He's a powerful being who's where in relation to the creation. Like way up here, right? The word, by the way, in the Hebrew, I don't expect you to know this about your stories. The word for God used in the first story is Elohim, which is a more of a generic God name, but it's supposed to be up here. The word for God over here, Yahweh, you all know where that one comes from, where? It's when Moses says, but what is your name? And God says, this is my name. So much more intimate. So what's God like in story one? Well, he's transcendent and he's hovering and he's creating from a distance. What's God in story two like? He's interactive. He's right there. He's building, he's forming, he's breathing. He's right here in the midst of the creation, not up over there. It's not the same story, right? So I'm gonna ask you to answer this and then I'll answer it. How do we think about these two stories? Now, real quick, I'm just curious. How many of you, that's a new exercise? You've never even thought about the differences between these first two. All right? Wow, that's good. I want to get just your response to that. How do you think about that? Is that like troubling? Or is it like, oh, that's kind of cool? Or I'm just curious. Where are you at right now? Good. We're going to come back to believing both in a little bit. Yeah. All right. I don't do this very often, but he's begging. Callum, what do you want to say, bud? You just want to raise your hand. What do you want to say? Go. Why do we always learn about Jesus? That's a great question. Because Jesus is really important. Jesus is the best. Such a great question. All right, somebody else. How do you think when you think about the two stories? Yeah, Laura. Right. How did I feel foolish after all these years that I missed this header that says, no, here's an account of how the earth was created after I just told you how it was created and not. Oh, you thought that was the conclusion of the first story. It's a footer. That's a one way of seeing it too. Yeah, for sure. We put those headings there. Except that what I would say is that it does switch from poetry to prose. And they chose to put that header there because it changes. It'd be like, you know, when we're reading in a book and you see like a quote or poetry and then it switches back to prose and we just see it visually. Hebrew, you see the same thing. Yes. And that's what some people do. Some people take Genesis 2 and tuck it into verse 126 of Genesis 1 and say, this is how it actually happened. But I want to say two things to that. What's that? For me, it just doesn't make sense that way, all right? So for those of you that want to hold them as one story, that's fine. I'm moving from here for the last 15 minutes, assuming they're two different stories, all right? Because otherwise, I don't have a sermon to give, all right? Because it's just the way I see it. So what do we do with two conflicting stories? I want to give you a quote. This is a guy, I don't even know who he is. He's some grad student somewhere, but I really liked how he summed up a lot of other reading I did. He said this, creation stories had an entirely different purpose in the ancient Near East, different from our purpose, which is to figure out where life started. They were written to give people a vision of their place in the world and to help them make sense of existence. In other words, they gave people a narrative in which they could live their lives. I think this is really important to understand. Post-Enlightenment, with the rise of science and the scientific theory, our obsession is with figuring everything out. How does it work? I can't tell you how often I go to YouTube and say, how does this work? So watch a video like, they're doing new power lines by my house. So on Saturday mornings at 7 o'clock, sure, let's fly the helicopter around your house over and over and over again. Love these people. And so I'm curious now, like, how do they run power lines? Which is a dumb, like, right? But we all have these things, like, and then that leads down the rabbit trail on YouTube, and then it's like 2 hours later, and now I know how, you know, every widget is made. We're obsessed with the question, where did we come from? And it's really hard for us to get this, but that wasn't the question they were worrying about. That wasn't their primary question. Their primary question was more about how do we live our lives? And they told these origin stories, they told them to give them a sense of where do we fit in the cosmos and how do we live our lives? Why do our lives even matter or not? And so they told stories like this all the time. And beginning like over the last 100 years or so, we found more and more and more of these stories. The Gilgamesh epic, we're not going to do a week on on Noah and the Ark, because we've done that in the past. And when I did that story years ago, I told you about the Gilgamesh epic, which is I think it's Sumerian or Arcadian, and it's a story that basically, what I read this week blew me away about the Gilgamesh epic. It's only one of hundreds of flood stories. Every culture, every ancient culture had a story about floods. It was important to every culture. And so one of the things we know now is that when Bible writers are writing, they're often writing with those stories in mind. It would be as if the Bible writers are writing the musical Burr. That's what they're doing all the time. They're telling a different story, and they want you to catch what's different about our story. So the first one, let me just take a couple minutes. The story number one type or origin story is known as the Enuma Elish, or if in the Canaanite version, it's called Baal versus Yam, or Yam if you're really hungry. So here's the story, real quick. A really quick down dirty version is that the god Marduk in the Enuma Elish fights with the god Tiamat. Tiamat's a lesser god, and there's something in the background about the nature of work that they don't want to work, and Marduk and Tiamat get in a big fight, and eventually Marduk defeats Tiamat. Now, interestingly, the word Tiamat is a reference to water, and that Marduk, when he defeats Tiamat, is pushing back the water. Well, think about the Creation 1 poem, or the Genesis 1 poem. How many times, how much of that poem is dedicated to God dividing the water, pushing back the water, separating the land from the water? Much of that poem has to do with water. And even more fun, the word in Genesis 1:2, where the Spirit of God hovers over the deep, do you know what the word is there in Hebrew? You shouldn't, but if you did, I was going to be really impressed. The word there is tahum. And it's related, the root in Hebrew language, there's no vowels and all that stuff. The root, you know what word it's related to? Tiamat. So this Genesis 1 poem about God pushing back and dividing the water and hovering over the Tahum is obviously, to people that are reading Hebrew and reading the Enuma Elish, it's obviously playing on the idea of the Enuma Elish. And in the Enuma Elish, the ending result, and there's a quote I'm going to read for you in a little bit about humans were built out of clay and blah, blah, blah. The point of the Enuma Elish is that human beings are created to be the servants of the gods. That the gods are lazy and don't want to do all the work, and somebody's got to do the work. And so human beings are here to do the work of the gods. Which if you're a priest or an aristocrat in Babylon, this is an awesome message, right? to tell your people that your place in this universe is that the gods are up here, and because I'm a priest or a king, I'm connected to the gods somehow, and in some of those religions, I am a god, in fact, and that your role is to do your work, put your head down and do your work, because this is what the gods have ordained from since time began. Is that a powerful message or what? Yeah. That's right. So that's what's happening in these stories. So the thing about the Enuma Elish and the story of Baal versus Yam, Yam, by the way, the reason I put this one here is it's the similar story, except Yam, the Canaanite god who Baal defeats, that word shows up in the Genesis poem too. Do you know where? It's related to the Hebrew word yom, which is the word for day, which shows up over and over again in the poem. And so it's like this thing where is if you've seen Hamilton and you go to the hit new show Burr that I'm creating, I keep putting references to Hamilton in it so you know, and you're like, oh, yeah. Oh, I see how you're riffing on that. It's like if you read Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, right? Like, you know Pride and Prejudice is sitting here, but they're zombies. Or Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Slayer, which is one of the best biopics of Abraham Lincoln I ever saw. It seems really true because it has the stovepipe hat and the beard and all of that. And it also has vampires that Abraham Lincoln is slaying in his spare time. And it's awesome. But when you read Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Slayer, you hear the history, right? You know the parts that you're like, oh yeah, this is our story. This is the story that I tell all the time. Oh, that's not part of the story at all. They didn't teach this in history class at all. Curse you, Dan Moore, that you don't teach vampires in your history class, right? You left so many good things out. But we're all a smart enough audience that we know that. And that's what makes it fun to watch Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Slayer, right? The same thing is happening here. It's fun for them. They know the Enuma Elish. They know the story that's told in Babylon, and they love to riff on it, because when they riff on it, they get to say what they want to say about their god, which is not the same thing that the Enuma Elish is saying about Marduk and Tiamat or Baal and Yam or any of these other gods and goddesses. I'm not going to spend any time here, but this type 2 origin story is one called Atrahasis. This was found alongside of the Gilgamesh epic. Some people believe that all of Genesis 1 through 11, the first 11 chapters of Genesis, are a play on the Atrahasis, in which, the same kind of thing as in Genesis 1, gods and goddesses and doing all this, and that the Genesis 1 narrative is a twist on this story. And here's the twist. I want to just jump to the twist. It's this. The format used in the opening chapters of Genesis clearly resembles the Enuma Elish, but it tells a completely different story. Instead of God mixing the blood of a dead god, that's Tiamat, with clay to make people, the god in Genesis simply breathes his own life into humanity with no struggle. Rather than making them slaves, this god makes them his image bearers, meaning that humans are to be his ambassadors and that they bear irrevocable worth. Contrary to seeing work as a bad thing, this god works, creates, cultivates, and then creates humans to be his co-creators, stewards, and caregivers to the creation. This presents an entirely new way of being human. Listen, I spent some of my life, my 20s, working through this passage trying to make all the science work. And I guess that's interesting or something. It's surely not anymore to me. I'm so much more excited about this understanding of Genesis. I'm so much more excited to look into this story and say, oh, what was happening is when the rabbis were telling these stories, they were looking around and saying, Babylonian culture says that your life has no worth. You are here to be a slave of the gods for the good of the priestly class and the aristocracy. But we're going to tell this story, and when we tell you this story about our God, we're going to use your story. We're going to use your cute little musical with hip-hop music in it. But we're going to tell it a different way. And when we tell our story, our God isn't like Marduk at all. Our God isn't like Baal at all. Our God, when he created us, gave us meaning and gave us worth, and made us co-conspirators in creation. Wound up the creation and said, hey, I'm done. Now you are my ambassadors. You all make it beautiful. It's good, but keep making it gooder. Right? Here's the thing. I think we read these now, and here's my gripe, is we've turned them into texts that we fight about, and we fight about whether they're true or not, or literal or not, or was that... Instead of going back to this place of just genuine beauty and awe of, look what these ancient storytellers were doing. They were taking these stories and saying, that's not our God, our God. Our lives matter. So I promised you that in this series, we would move from those origin stories, and I wouldn't just do the geeky Elish, Enuma Elish, and Marduk, and all that stuff, because I know some of you are like, oh, seriously, get on with it, right? But to get to the spot of how does this impact my story? So obviously, right? You matter. You matter. What you do tomorrow, what you do today, what you do with your life actually matters. You're not just doing what you do because God is up here and put your head down and do your work and shut up. But rather, your life matters. You are an image bearer. You hold in you, you shine out of you the imago Dei, the image of God. The same creative force that creates the world. That's good. And my mic cut out at the same time. That was a magical thing that just happened. Where was I? I felt like I was in some good place. It's Imago Dei. Hey! Should name a church that. And then nobody will ever know what you're talking about. It'd be like a code. Oops. Can't undo that decision. I just think... I was saying last week when I was setting up this series that the quote from Rob Bell about how these stories have so much to say about our current condition. I think this has so much to say. And frankly, honestly, even some people that tell this story from a Christian's perspective miss this point. Sometimes in some Christian tellings of the story, we place God up here so far out of reach of human beings and that God is... turning the knobs, and I mean, seriously, maybe, I hope your Facebook feed isn't filled with such drivel as mine, but seriously, there's people already declaring that the hurricanes moving up Florida is God's judgment of this person or that person or this thing or that thing. And it's so ridiculous. You are just, like, in God's way, God has a point to make, gone humans. And I don't think that's the story of Genesis 1. I've been thinking a lot. I've mentioned this book a couple times, The Happiness Advantage, and one of the chapters I was reading, and he was talking about the difference between a job, a career, and a calling. And so the question is, if I matter, what's my calling? What's your calling? We talk about calling sometimes only when we're talking about people in career ministry. But I think every single one of us has a calling. Every single one of us has something you were put on this planet to do. You have a gift in you. And I'm sorry, it might be a bummer for you that where you work tomorrow morning isn't the place where you get to exercise that gift. I wish that was true for everyone. And for some of you, it is. Some of you know that when you clock in tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, you get to do the thing that you were put on this planet to do. And you should do that and remind yourself of why you do what you do. And some of you are working for the weekend, right? Like, you know that the thing that you're going to get paid for tomorrow to go do, you just got to get that done so you can get out of there and get back to the business of doing what it is that you were put on this planet to do. And some of you were put on here to cult. I like the idea that in that list earlier, there's not only the creating of things, but there's the cultivating of things. It's not just the planting of the garden, it's the weeding of the garden as well. It's not just the landscaping, it's mowing the yard too. It's not just the creation of the food and the making of the dinner, it's the cleaning up of the dinner that goes with that too. All of it counts and you matter. And so everything you do isn't wasted. Nothing you do is wasted. I need to write a good quote like that about how nothing we do is wasted. N.T. Wright already wrote a long one that we read at Easter every year. And if you're not around, just hang on till Easter and I'll read a really good quote about this. The second thing I want to spend just a second with is, I said this last week, but I want to point at it again here. Conflict about how we think about God is absolutely no big deal. The first pages of the Bible are conflicted in some of their tellings of how they think about God. It's fine. Hegemony is not a value in the church. At least not in this one. I know it is in many churches. I just don't think it should be. Making sure we're all on the same page and we all say the same thing. And you might actually believe this morning that God is sending his hurricane to smite Florida. I really strongly disagree with you. And you're welcome to be here. Love you. I know somebody that does think that, I'm pretty sure. And it's okay. We're still going to be in relationship together because people have always, always, always been wrestling and disagreeing about what they think about God. Do I have a minute? I do. I have 2 minutes. All right. So this week on Facebook, somebody what prompted it, and it was a really respectful ask, but the person linked me to an article about polyamory, and it was a Christian making an argument for polyamory, and he was saying, like, you know, I've read Facebook, and you just seem to be pro-gay marriage, and so isn't it a slippery slope into polyamory? For all of you, polyamory means many loves, right? So he's like, slippery slope, you know, aren't you just, is everything okay? Or is there any standards in the Bible? And so first of all, I wanted to say, I didn't say this to him back, but I just want to say here, it's really fun, is why does the slippery slope always apply to the going left or more liberal? Doesn't the slippery slope go both ways? If there is, I deny slippery slopes, but if there is a slippery slope, it goes both ways, all right? Your position is getting increasingly more conservative or something. But that's an aside. So I was trying to respond to the person, and I was doubling down on this idea in our church of Romans 14, that even when you disagree with each other, what do when we disagree? Oh, come on, please, you know these words. We accept everyone. We accept each other. And the person said to me, like, well, I just don't think this is a disputable matter. And I didn't respond this way, but I want to say to you all here, because I thought about it just like a couple days ago, and it was too late to say this. You don't just get to declare that something's not disputable. I'm disputing you. So by definition, disputable matter. Like, if Chris and I are having an argument about something, he can't just say, well, we're not arguing. We are arguing. I don't agree with you. So you've either got to say, like, I'm not a Christian, or we actually have a dispute. And the Bible's super clear that when we have a dispute, we accept each other. If we have a dispute about what we think about the Genesis passage, we accept each other. If the Bible isn't even sure among itself how Judas died or how the mechanics of the creation, we'll just put them both in. Which creation story is the actual scientific one? I don't know. Let's just put them both in and let them work it out for generations. Cool. It's okay. It's okay to argue, and it's okay to not agree, and it's okay. What's not okay is being a jerk about it and calling people Christian every time we disagree, unchristian every time we disagree with them, and calling them heretics and all those other things. And I just want to say, like, as part of this, because this is deep, and I wanted to spend time here because this is deep in the DNA of who this church is. This is who we are, is we are people that want to keep on accepting each other even if we disagree about various things. Even if we disagree with everything I've said this morning about this being two stories, we're going to keep accepting each other. Even if you believe hurricanes, accept each other. Even if, whatever, we're going to keep accepting each other. Because this is what we see always. The scriptures are doing it with themselves. And if the scriptures can hold disagreement, I think we should too. And people say to me all the time, like, boy, that's a lot you're asking of your church. You're asking people to hold that tension. I'm sorry, but the scriptures as they come to us come with that tension already built in. How can we have it any other way as a church? Let's pray, because I'm now 2 minutes over. I'm blaming it on the microphone, officially. Let's pray. God, help us believe what these ancient rabbis believed when they put the scriptures together, that our lives actually matter. Help us to believe that. It's easy not to believe that in the ebb and flow of daily life at work and home and just everything else. It's just, help us to believe that our lives matter and count, and that the gifts that you've given us matter to this world. And God, when we find ourselves in places of conflict and we want to push the other person away and say, you're not part of me, help us to hold and embrace conflict.
to hold and embrace difference and to accept each other anyways. In your name I pray, amen.